This is Muse. It's good to have you with us. Iran has categorically rejected as baseless U.S.'s accusations regarding the Islamic Republic's involvement in the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran's ambassador to the U.N., Amir Saeed Erivani, dismissed as, quote, misleading and entirely unfounded U.S. attempts to establish an illusory link between the alleged use of drones in the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the Security Council Resolution 2231 to accuse Iran of violating this resolution. In a letter to the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, the Iranian diplomat underlined that Tehran has, on several occasions, rejected these groundless allegations. He said the U.S. seeks not only to mislead the international community, but also to manipulate the U.N. mandate to serve its own political interests. Iran's foreign ministry condemns the new Western sanctions against the country and its media over its response to the deadly riots that broke out last year. The reaction comes after the U.S., the EU, and Britain slapped sanctions on dozens of Iranian individuals and entities, including Press TV. The foreign ministry's spokesman says such measures are meddlesome and hypocritical attempts to sow sedition inside of Iran. Nasser Kanani says the bans come from countries that violate the rights of their citizens, especially women and minorities, on a regular basis. He's also warning European politicians that unconstructive measures are not in line with their interests. The spokesman says Europeans should start respecting Iran's sovereignty. Human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi tells us how U.S. sanctions are backfiring in more ways than one.
These sanctions are obviously another way of the U.S. empire showing how weak they are. Countries like the U.S. use sanctions as a tool to undermine the economic stability of countries like the Islamic Republic. They think of it as a tool that will weaken a country, but it has proven to be on the contrary. The U.S. in the past has sanctioned China. They've sanctioned Russia as well. And today we see that China and Russia have both economically flourished. As a matter of fact, I don't think I would be exaggerating if I would say that when a country like the U.S. that is so dependent on import, is so dependent on its export, when it sanctions countries like the Islamic Republic, Russia, or China, it is actually harming its own economy. It's harming its own people. A capitalist country like the U.S. really can't afford sanctions. Whereas these sanctions have, in a lot of ways, benefited the Islamic Republic in a sense that it has forced the Islamic Republic to develop economic policies that rely more on self-reliance.
Mourning ceremonies are underway across Iran to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. The northeastern city of Mashhad, which is home to the Imam Reza Shrine, is hosting about 4.5 million pilgrims who have converged on the holy city to mourn their late Imam. Hundreds of thousands of mourners from across Iran have also walked all the way to Mashhad. Measures have been taken to house the pilgrims. The martyrdom anniversary of Imam Reza, which falls on September 16 this year, is a national holiday in Iran. Iraq says it has wiped out anti-Iran terror groups from areas in Erbil province near the border with Iran. In a statement, the commander of the Iraqi border guards said its forces have taken back the border areas, which were under the control of terrorist groups. According to the statement, Iraq is determined to maintain security in the regions bordering its neighbors. The development comes just days after the Iraqi foreign minister paid a visit to Iran. Fuad Hussein on Wednesday assured the Islamic Republic that Iraq will not let any terror group use its soil as a launch pad to attack neighboring countries, including Iran. He also expressed Baghdad's commitment to security pacts with Tehran. The Israeli military has launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip after regime forces opened fire on Palestinian protesters along the barrier bordering the coastal territory. The regime's military has claimed that the airstrike targeted an observation post belonging to the Hamas resistance group. The military says it was a response to what it called the riots near the fence separating the besieged region from the occupied territories. Reports say the strike was carried out with a drone. Spokesman for the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slammed the attack, saying that it shows the criminal behavior of the regime. Earlier on Friday, hundreds of Gazans held rallies near the fence east of Gaza in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Israeli forces fired rubber-coated bullets and tear gas, wounding a dozen Palestinians. The correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says that Israel wants to instill fear among Palestinians, but nothing will stop them from continuing their resistance.
Nothing has happened to prompt the Israeli regime to carry out two drone attacks against Hamas security observation posts in the east of Gaza City, except for the peaceful protests that were held along the security fence and along the so-called buffer zone east of the Gaza Strip. All of a sudden, after the protests ended, Israeli drones fired a rocket east of the Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City, and minutes later they fired another rocket east of central Gaza. They want to instill fear into Palestinians, especially the protesters. Palestinians in Gaza, a very young population, nearly 53% of Gazans are children under the age of 18, and this is why most of the injuries during attacks and even during protests and during wars are children and young people, and it seems nothing will stop them from continuing the struggle.
Waterlogged streets, upturned vehicles, and damaged infrastructure. That's the scene of northeastern Libya, where devastating floods last weekend left a trail of death and destruction. More than 11,000 people have been confirmed dead, while thousands more remain missing after Mediterranean Storm Daniel hit coastal towns and cities. Derna is the worst hit city, where the storm swept away entire neighborhoods, causing two dams to collapse. Over 2,200 buildings have been destroyed there. Rescue teams are trying to extract possible survivors from under the rubble. Thousands of corpses are also washing up or decaying under the rubble, which adds to the problems facing residents. Libyan authorities are burying victims in mass graves, despite warnings of health impacts in the region. The UN report says that over 1,000 people have so far been buried in mass graves. Burkina Faso's foreign ministry expels the French embassy's military attaché over what it called subversive activities. This is the latest anti-France move by its former colonies in Africa's Sahel region. The ministry says the attaché and his team have 2 weeks to leave the country. Burkina Faso is also closing the French military mission there. Several French media outlets have also been suspended in the country over the past months. Similarly, in neighboring Niger, anti-French sentiment is still strong. French President Emmanuel Macron is accusing Nigerian military rulers of taking French ambassador hostage.
In Niger, we have an ambassador and diplomatic staff who are literally being held hostage in the French embassy as I speak. Food deliveries have been prevented. They are eating military rations and they are staying there because, quite simply, France, which supports democracy and considers that there are no double standards for Africa, considers that President Bazoum, who is being held hostage in his own country, is the legitimately elected president.
Cross comments come as the French ambassador has so far refused to leave Niger, even after being ordered to do so. The country's new rulers have also torn up military cooperation agreements with France, asking French troops to leave quickly. People in Niger have also held several mass rallies in support of the new government since it took over power in July. People are also demanding the withdrawal of French soldiers. The leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has paid a visit to an airbase in Russia's Far East as he continues his official trip that has irked the West. According to the Russian Defense Minister, Kim Jong-un inspected Russian nuclear-capable bombers. He was accompanied by Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu to the airbase outside of the city of Vladivostok. Other Russian warplanes were also on display. Kim arrived in Russia's Far East on Tuesday and held a summit with the Russian President Vladimir Putin 1 day later. The U.S. and its allies suspect the two leaders may have clinched an arms deal. Moscow and Pyongyang deny that. The pair, however, did say they want to boost their defense cooperation.
Leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Kim Jong-un, traveled to Russia this week for a tour and summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The DPRK's Kim visited a cosmodrome as he hopes to develop satellite technology.
I am honored that President Putin has shown a deep interest, provided an opportunity to engage in a conference at a space launch facility, and given us a chance to gain deeper understanding of the current and future of a space power nation.
The DPRK leader also toured a jet fighter facility as Russia and the DPRK deepen their relations. Warnings from the U.S. against DPRK-Russia cooperation continued, this time from officials planning extended deterrence with their South Korean counterparts.
In the context of mounting DPRK threats to regional stability, the United States will continue its efforts to counter any and all threats to the U.S.-ROK alliance.
The U.S. strategy of extended deterrence refers to the so-called nuclear umbrella, the U.S. commitment to use all of its forces, including nuclear weapons, in defense of an ally, in this case, South Korea. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to strengthen that commitment with the routine deployment here of U.S. nuclear-capable weapons. Experts in Seoul, however, feel that the deployment of more U.S. weapons causes the DPRK only to invest further in its own military deterrence.
These actions by South Korea, the United States, and Japan are not contributing to eliminating the DPRK's nuclear weapons, but bringing the DPRK, China, and Russia closer and militarily strengthening the country. So the attempted deterrence of the DPRK's nuclear program is actually causing its nuclear program and missiles to be strengthened.
Earlier this week, South Korea announced its intention to purchase 25 more U.S. F-35 Joint Strike Fighter jets. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The International Organization for Migration says the U.S.-Mexico border is the world's deadliest land route for migrants. The agency recorded nearly 700 deaths and disappearances there last year, although the figure is likely an undercount due to a lack of official data. The IOM said the official figure represented nearly half of the migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas in 2022.
The UN Migration Agency, IOM, has raised the alarm over the high number of migrants killed while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It has described the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest land route for migrants. At least 686 deaths and disappearances were reported in the border crossing last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded through the Americas in 2022, the deadliest year on record since IOM's Missing Migrants Project began in 2014. The data underscores the growing death toll and increasing risks that migrants face throughout the region. These figures represent the lowest estimates available, as many more deaths are likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Nearly half of the deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and the Chihuahuan deserts, far more than other desert regions where irregular migration is prevalent.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico in hopes of reaching the U.S. border to apply for protection. Many are fleeing rampant gang violence, poverty, political persecution, and other crises in their home countries. This is while the U.S. is accused of ignoring the plight of migrants. From an economic perspective, it is the U.S. that benefits from the contribution of migrants to the nation's GDP. Many of those immigrants that come to the U.S. through its southern borders end up working in farms and construction sites owned by big companies. It's been argued that increased immigration promotes U.S. economic growth and helps tackle labor shortages and inflation.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico to reach the U.S. However, the U.S. President Joe Biden has put new restrictions in place, launching new programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier.
U.S. President Joe Biden, who is under pressure from Republicans, has launched new restrictions and programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier. The measures have been put in place amid record numbers of arrivals at the border since he took office in early 2021. The measures introduced by the Biden administration include a rule that disqualifies people from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they did not first apply in countries that they crossed earlier in their journeys. Rights groups have slammed the measure as an asylum ban. The Biden administration has also opened so-called safe mobility centers in Latin America to allow asylum seekers to apply for U.S. protection in third countries instead of at the border with Mexico. But migrants and asylum seekers continue to head to the border. For years, Central American nations have stepped up immigration enforcement efforts, often at the behest of the United States, erecting new obstacles for the steady stream of people making the journey north. The journey is plagued with violence, with areas under the control of criminal networks and armed groups.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Here at Arabic English Radio, express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rizal, peace be upon him, Dave's infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Eric Garner went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever.
Medical said Eric Garner.
I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
Is death not being called a homicide?
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There
on compassion.
You'll see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, but protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before of what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, black lives matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations. It appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at the given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them and have them go before a jury of his peers.
Yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
She needs that consistency.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Garner in a chokehold. Garner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Garner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Garner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Garner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part
of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat on around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop, wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I'd never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story. And it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened.
The case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Gardner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person, because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid of teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
Police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Almighty, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear listeners. You are listening to IRI English Radio. This is the program of For a Better Life. I am Beta at your service. And in this episode, again, we're going to talk about something really controversial and important for having a better life. As you know, as a Muslim, we are living in a Muslim society, which we call it Ummah. And this Ummah is actually really important. So in order to make it better, in order to develop it to the level that Islam wants it to be, we all have responsibility. The Holy Quran also makes clear to us that the love of the Ahlulbayt is one of the responsibilities we have in our social life and in our Muslim ummah, and is obligatory. Say, I do not ask of you any reward for it, the message, but love for my near relatives. Holy Quran. The Prophet of Allah interpreted and explained this verse to the Muslims by saying that near relatives refer to the household of the Messenger of Allah, Muhammad, peace be upon him. So when they heard the verse, the Muslims asked the Holy Prophet, who are your near relatives, whose love Allah has made obligatory on us? The Messenger of Allah replied, Ali, Fatima, and her two sons, Hassan and Hussein, peace be upon them. So we understand that love for Ahlul Bayt and their offsprings is an obligation upon all Muslims. On Judgment Day, they will be questioned about this love. And whoever departs from the love of Ahlul Bayt indeed departs from one of the obligatory duties of his religion and becomes distant from the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And do not forget that the best wisdom is to fear Allah. So let's keep it here. We're going to have a short break. Stay tuned, dear listeners.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. All I need. It's all I need. All I need. All I need. It's all I need.
This is IRB English Radio. You're listening to the program For a Better Life. I am Vita, and in this part of the episode, accordingly, we're talking about the social principles that we have to follow in order to have a better life. We talked about this love of Ahlul Bayt, which is one of our duties as a Muslim. And this is one of the biggest responsibilities that we have on our shoulders, and it's going to be questioned on the Resurrection Day. And another thing which I want to mention in this part of the episode is how to act upon the Holy Quran. Our Holy Prophet Muhammad said, whoever makes unlawful deeds lawful never believed in the Quran. The Holy Quran is Allah's message revealed to Prophet Muhammad through his angel Gabriel. Allah the Almighty ordered the Prophet to convey it to all people, to guide them towards peace and goodness, to instruct them in useful actions, and to teach them to abstain from evil actions and corruption. Thus, the Quran teaches us issues and matters related to our religion, which among them are to believe in Allah, His angels, His prophets, and the Day of Judgment. As we talked about this belief in the last episode, this belief is one of the most important factors of being an individual who is capable of having a better life and put his life in a better level. Another thing is to develop good manners and behavior, like telling the truth, love, cooperation, respect of parents, and etc. So at this level, you are making all that belief into a practical thing. And the third thing, which I want to mention in this part of the episode, is to show us what is lawful or permitted and what is unlawful or forbidden, urging us towards lawful deeds and forbidding us from unlawful ones. For instance, Allah made the following deeds unlawful: robbery, suicide, gambling, lying, injustice, wronging our neighbors, helping oppressors and those guilty of wrongdoing, eating dead animals or the flesh of swine, pork, and drinking alcohol. These were just some examples of forbidden things that you have to keep away from in order to have a better life. It is obligatory for us as Muslims to give up these forbidden deeds and other that the Holy Quran specifies as forbidden haram. This is because we believe that everything which is forbidden is useless and fruitless for us and for other people. And in order to believe in that, we have to keep that in mind, that Allah is the wisest of all. So if He is telling us to keep away from something, to if He is actually forbidding us from doing something, then there is a reason behind that. And here you can see the importance of belief, the first level, the first step and the first stage I talked about. If you have a strong belief, if you have a strong love, if you have passion for Allah Almighty, then the road will be somehow smooth for you. It will be easier for you because you have the protection of Allah Almighty before you. So I think we need to go for a break. Just keep all that in mind, and we're gonna come back for the last part of the episode. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIP English Radio. Up to here, we were talking about the responsibilities that we have according to the Holy Quran. Therefore, it doesn't please us to be beaten or have our property stolen or to be deceived or oppressed because I told you we are forbidden to do these things. Indeed, whoever gives up deeds forbidden by the Holy Quran is a truthful believer of the Quran as Allah's word, and he always follows it during his life. Whoever doesn't give up these forbidden actions and does them as if they are lawful is one who doesn't believe that the Quran is Allah's word revealed to his prophet, because he doesn't give up what Allah, the Most High, has forbidden. Hence, we should think whether a certain act is lawful or unlawful before saying or doing anything. If it is lawful, we may do it, but if it is unlawful, we must abstain from doing it. Our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, says, "Man is never a true believer unless he gives up deeds forbidden by the Quran." Most surely, it is an honored Quran in a preserved book. So the gist of today's episode somehow was like, you have to keep always that in mind. If you are claiming that you have the love of Allah in your heart, then you have to prove it practically. So in order to prove that in yourself, you have to practice it in everyday life. And one of the best ways to practice it is to keep away from all of the forbidden things that are in Quran. Thank you for listening to me. It was all the time I had for today's episode. Wait for more things, for more hints, and for more beautiful quotes and narrations in the following episodes. Thank you for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah
knows. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Tehran rejects the U.S. claims on Iran's involvement in the Ukraine war, accusing Washington of manipulating the U.N. for its political interests. The Israeli military launches an airstrike on the Gaza Strip after opening fire on Palestinian protesters along the barrier dividing the besieged territory,